super tight raspberry, a little bit of meat, roasted meat.
Craig, you don't know what meat tastes like.
What the hell is a tight raspberry?
Tightly wound, maybe.
Tightly wound. Yeah. Like it's rich and fully ripe, but it's not preserves. It's not syrup.
Okay.
Unctuous raspberry.
Ooh.
What's the ABV on this? It smells kind of boozy.
13. It's warm in here. That's why.
And also, it's like so herbal and savory that maybe it seems hot.
Man, I just like the minerality on this thing. You know, you really do get that whetstone kind of dirty violet, blackberry, cassis. There's just so much going on.
Yeah, it does have this herbal peppery thing, though. Kind of that's distracting me from the other flavors.
And stony. I like your word sanguine. This is that quality here.
I think we're going to find, in these four examples, we're going to get a lot of that sort of meaty, kind of bloody, but more reserved. But what things I'm hearing you guys say about this wine, fruit, earth, right? Earthy qualities, meaty characteristics, savory characteristics, floral characteristics. So when we're talking about complexity in wine, we're talking about this kind of stuff right here.
It's just the wine burrito here.
There
it's
it is.
It's got everything.
Yeah, but not from Taco Bell. This is a 100% Syrah from the Appellation Côte Rôti, means roasted slope in the Northern Rhone. This is a 2014, and this is from Domaine Jamet. And in wine circles, is kind of known as one of the best producers in the Côte Rôti Appellation.
So, Kristen, we're going to have a lot of fun because we're talking about
Syrah and the Northern Rhone.
Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening to another episode of Barrel to Bottle, the Binny's Podcast. I'm Greg Versch. I do communications at Binny's. In the room with me today,
Pat Brophy, Director of Spirit Sales.
I'm Kristen Ellis, Wine Education at Binny's.
Hey, I'm Roger Adamson, doing Beer Marketing and Education.
And joined again in the studio today,
I'm Barb Stedman, Assistant Director of Wine Sales.
And a Rhone enthusiast?
For sure. Northern Rhone in particular. Yep. Thanks for inviting me.
It's one of the most visited regions in France, just because people move up and down that 500 or so mile long, you know, stretch of Rhone River. It's one of the, you know, few very well traversed rivers in France still. So you can see those very famous, very steep hillsides where the Syrah grows.
And it'll get you down to the Mediterranean eventually, right?
Yeah. Well, so the Rhone River in itself, I think, is an amazing piece of water. So it starts its life way up in the Alps in Switzerland. It spills into Lake Geneva. Then from Lake Geneva, it drops 6,000 feet in that 500 miles before it spills out into the Mediterranean Sea. So it hooked up the Saone River, which goes through the region of Burgundy in Lyon, and then it flows down to the Mediterranean.
So you can see that a fast-moving river like that would carve steep slopes in a valley.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yep. And the Romans actually carved those steep slopes. So the Northern Rhone, as far as a region, I mean, we go all the way back, very typical in European history to go back to the Greeks. But in terms of the importance of this region, it really was the ancient Romans landed there about 120 BC. And they noticed that they could grow quality wine right along the riverbanks. And they began to basically to prevent erosion, to cut in these terraces into the steep hillsides. And we still enjoy those terraces today. We're still using a lot of those same terraces to grow Syrah. Dude, like, that's awesome.
So you know? History, I mean, that like incredible history.
Yes. And the history of Syrah, otherwise known as Shiraz or Shiraz, as some people say.
Shirazmatazz.
Dude, can we call the podcast that? Shirazmatazz.
I think that ship sailed like a year ago.
Thank you.
So they were like, you know, Syrah's from here and there, thought maybe it was a Persian grape, you know, after the city of Shiraz, which is in, I think, modern day Iraq now, but it's not. It's native to the Rhone, as well as Viognier. And its grandfather, I believe, is Pinot Noir. So it just kind of mutated and was crossed with the other vinifera varieties, but it is native to the northern Rhone region. Here we are with Jean-Paul Jamet, right, from Côte Rôti. This is $125, and this is the kind of epicenter of all things Syrah. It's like the number one expression. It's not, it's a baby. I mean, it's got so much life to it that I think that you're kind of missing a lot. Drinking young Côte Rôti is not really that fun.
Yeah, that's something. You were thinking about decanting these.
I did. I decanted these for 2 hours. Yeah.
Wow.
And it's still very tight. It's not giving a lot. Like, this thing needs another 10 years in the bottle, I would say.
It's tremendous, though.
What happens after 10 years about all that minerality and the iron and the floral and the fruit? What's going to happen long term?
Well, the minerality will stay. The floral will go from fresh flowers to more dried, and the fruit will sort of drop away.
Okay.
And Syrah gains leathery, meaty aromas with age. So you're going to get even more of that leather component.
Even stinkier for you, Pat.
No, I like leather. It's one of my favorite
leather-bound
flavors.
Leather-bound books?
Yeah. No, I get a lot of leather in certain whiskeys and stuff, so.
This wine is 100% Syrah. So Syrah really kind of is known in two different styles. So you can see Syrah or something, or nothing, or a place name, or you can see Shiraz. Syrah kind of is supposed to mean this kind of style, an old world style, hearkening back to the Northern Rhone. And this is kind of one of the, I guess I would say, you know, prototypes, benchmark styles of Syrah from the Northern Rhone. I want to talk about the Syrah grape a little bit, just about the grape itself before we jump into the wines, actually.
Cool.
So as you can see by this wine, but Syrah will produce very deeply pigmented, very tannic wines that are relatively high in acid. So these are just on par, Syrahs from the Northern Rhone, in terms of ageability with Burgundy and with Bordeaux. So like I said, the names are tossed out just like those high-end wines from those more famous regions. So the raspberry, blackcurrant, cherry, white pepper, violet, meaty, bloody, it kind of can really only come from this area of Northern Rhone. You don't get so much of this bloody and earthy quality in other places, as far as my experience is concerned.
So like if we're like a Syrah from Washington State isn't going to have that same kind of quality.
Not as much. Yeah. I find the terroir there, it's kind of more of that inky black fruit forward. And they tend to have a little bit more overt oak here in the Northern Rhone. They do use oak, but generally it's used oak. So no new oak aromas or first and second use at best.
They may be heading that way, though. I mean, you're talking about the vines in Washington being so much younger than generally the vines in the Northern Rhone. But I think when the book is written, Syrah is really going to be the biggest player there in Washington.
Yeah, in the last 5 years, it's really turned a corner. Hmm. Really good stuff coming out of Washington State, that's for sure.
Yeah, different style.
So its ability to age makes it so sought after. I think that Syrah doesn't sell very well, but like around wine circles, I mean, it's delicious. Everybody loves it. You know what I mean?
It's like a wine nerd's wine.
I think so. Mm-hmm.
And that it's, even when it's been in its trendiest throughout the world, it's even then been kind of a wine nerd's wine.
Yep, for sure. So relatively late budding, which is good because in the Northern Rhone especially, there is a continental climate, which means there's a big frost risk. And so the fact that it buds late means that we can have good ripened fruit, you know, at the proper time during the growing season. Other special features of the Northern Rhone, of course, it's going to be those steep hillsides, you guys, where the Syrah variety grows. The Mistral Wind. Have you seen those t-shirts where it says, "I love the Mistral Wind"?
No one's seen that t-shirt.
Just seen that t-shirt.
That's a made-up t-shirt.
They're actually t-shirts, and I've seen people at Rhone tastings wearing them. It says, wow. I was like, huh.
Again, it's a wine nerd's wine.
So the Mistral Wind is
That's
this.
That's how you find a spouse. Someone that has that t-shirt on.
For me?
Game over.
No, I was going to say, no.
If you find someone that actually knows what that is, or even better, is wearing one as well. Match made.
So the Mistral Wind is this wind that is born in the North Sea. It's this cold set of air that's pulled down by the hot landmass of the Mediterranean Basin, and then, of course, the Mediterranean Sea. So this wind blows down the Rhone River at like 60 miles an hour. So in the Southern Rhone, it causes the vines to actually bend southward, and they grow kind of bent over. But in the Northern Rhone, they're sort of saved by those steep terraces, so they don't have that much of an issue. But it keeps the air clean, keeps the clouds away, keeps the sun keeps the sun ripening these grapes for proper ripening, because Syrah, of course, needs lots of heat and lots of sun to ripen properly. So it's just a perfect little microclimate for Syrah.
So it buds late. Is harvest around the same time as other places in France, or does it harvest later too?
No, it's relatively early ripening, actually. Hmm. So it's really pretty good for that frost that might bookend a continental season, or continental climate, rather. Yeah. All right.
Is this big minerality just from the soil, or is it perceived minerality from other factors?
Yeah, I caution you to make a correlation between minerality in wine and soil. It's generally from higher acid wines that grow in cooler climates. It's from sulfurous compounds due to fermentation and other things like that. There is no direct link between the soil type and smelling minerality in wine. All right, so the soils there, guys, are important. Lots of granite. Granite soils, folks out there studying wine, means deep, dense, powerful, age-worthy wines. That's what we're after.
So if they're so age-worthy, and to, I guess, Greg's point and yours, why do people buy so much Cabernet and so much Bordeaux for their cellars and less of these great, cellar-worthy, intense Syrah?
I don't know. I think people are just more comfortable with Cabernet. It's kind of like what everybody grew up on, drinking California wine, then they graduate to Bordeaux, you know, and that's just what people buy.
I honestly think that.
And I think that there's just so much more Bordeaux out there.
Where are these priced comparable to Bordeaux or Napa Cab?
In the higher end, they're right up there. Mm. Yeah, between $50 and $150 bucks a bottle.
And your hyper collectible ones can be
$400 or $500. But Bordeaux then far exceeds it, because some of those really, really high first growths can come about $1,000 bucks a bottle on release in good vintages.
But then also there's values, just like anywhere else, that you can get a really great fun bottle, maybe more of the Southern Rhone, for like $12, and then from the Northern Rhone for like $15 or $30.
Well, you're making, well, so the Northern Rhone has all those steep terraces, so you cannot mechanize anything, right? It's so difficult to just even grow vines there, to take care of your vineyards, to harvest them. And plus, Syrah can be a little bit difficult in the winery. It reduces very easily. So reductive wine means it doesn't take oxygen on very easily, so it can kind of smell stinky and tired and just not very bright. And fresh.
A feeling and smell I'm familiar with.
In the Southern Rhone, it's relatively flat land, right? There are mountains, but compared to the Northern Rhone, so they can, you know, grow much easily there, much more easily there than they can in the Northern Rhone. It's just expensive. The cost to pay to play. It's backbreaking work, man, to harvest. That's why Mosel Rieslings are so expensive, because you have to carry grapes on your back up a 60-degree gradient, you know, terrace to the winery. That sucks.
On gravel. Just clinging to the side
of
the hill.
And then after harvest, go down and collect all the rocks that fell down during the year and bring them back up to the top. So as far as traditional versus modern, these guys use what are called demis or demi-muid. So it's good to know for the Northern Rhone that they use traditionally a 600-liter old oak barrel for maturation.
That's a big butt.
That's a big ass butt. Yep. So it's called the demi. So when you go to the Northern Rhone, there are 8 appellations in the Northern Rhone. We started in the furthest north of the Northern Rhone in the Côte Rôtie, moving on down, and we are going to go on the left bank to Hermitage. So Hermitage is supposed to be kind of the number one after Côte Rôtie in terms of quality appellations. This is the Barreau Lynch, so it's the Louis Barreau family. What's the vintage on this one, Greg?
2016.
Cool. So the word Hermitage, what does it kind of remind you of?
A place where hermits live?
Exactly. So it got its name from some dude who camped up on the hill in the medieval times for like 30 years and never left. So he was like the hermit of the hill. So now it's one of the most expensive wines in the world. Go figure, right? So this is from one Loudi called La Perrielle, basically just a dialect for stones of the area.
2016.
Yeah, I gotta taste it.
It's so ripe, but it's not just ripe, it's constrained ripeness. It's so polished.
Oh man, this is violet and pretty and blackberry and raspberry and a little jammy.
Blueberry extract.
Yeah, I got lots of blueberry and 100%, so much flowers.
Yeah. Hand harvested, so macerations for about 3 weeks, fermentations in cement, and aged in no new oak for about 1 to 2 years, the barrels are.
It's so interesting.
But aged for 15 months, sorry.
It's interesting in succession that there's just so much freshness. I don't know if everyone else is getting that, but it has a lot of the same structure and tannin, but it's just so much more lift on the finish, and it feels more youthful and light on its feet. I love that.
Hey, non-wine guys who were complaining about the horsiness and funkiness.
Yeah, stinkiness.
Of the last one. Is this not like a good call and response for that? It's so polished. And it's not like commercially polished. It's just sleek.
Yeah, no, this wine both smells and tastes great.
good descriptor.
Thanks, non-wine guy.
Yeah, no problem. You know, it does, I get where you're saying it's a little tight, though. It seems like it needs time to soften up a bit. Am I wrong in that?
I think that the palate feels relatively soft. I think the tannins are quite moderate and very, very silky. I think we've got a good amount of acidity here that's offering the structure. I think that that's kind of at the forefront. But it's relatively balanced, because what I'm finding the balance is the concentration of flavor and the acidity. That's kind of what's playing off of itself to me right now.
And it has a pillowy plushness. And if it was from California, you would assume that it was from big globs of oak, but it's not. And it's from the grapes themselves.
Mm-hmm. Hashtag pillowy plushness. I like the berry character to this. It's very pronounced.
I love this wine. I don't even really want, I know we have to move on, but I kind of don't want to.
Yeah, it's very enjoyable. Mm-hmm. Good pick.
You guys, they've been making wine down in the Rhone for 16 generations. And they have a villa that's in Gigondas that was used by the ancient Romans. And in their wine cellar, they have ancient Roman amphorae and different machines that they use to make wine embedded in the walls of their cellar. Like, that's my dream.
So this wine smells terrific.
You like this one?
Oh, yeah.
So another 100% Syrah.
It's so rich.
Hermitage is a tiny appellation. So think about the Northern Rhone. The Rhone together, north and south, they do about 66 million gallons of wine a year, give or take. At least they did that a couple of years ago. And the Northern Rhone does 4% of that. So the Southern Rhone, think of that as more of the quantity-driven area of the Rhone. The Northern Rhone is really just about quality and super tiny production.
What was the wine again?
This is Hermitage La Perrielle by Baru Lynch.
How Baru much would this Lynch cost on a shelf
this
that
is? This one is, well, hold on, I have the price. Hold on.
I'd say $60.
$75.99. So here's a place you guys can experience Rhone and experience maybe some of the terroir of the Hermitage Hill, basically just one tiny little appellation, is by buying Groz Hermitage. So you see this hyphenated C-R-O-Z-E-S. It's kind of like the baby Hermitage, so to speak. And then you just kind of really have to search for reputable producers. And I chose the J.L. Chave selection. It's the Negociant line from Chave. And Groz Hermitage, are you laughing at me because I sound like a distributor rep?
No, I'm laughing at this label. Is this connotating the bum wine aspect? It's like this fighting bum on there.
Isn't that the guy who's schlepping the grapes up the hill?
That's probably the hermit.
It's the hermit.
You're right, Roger. It's a ridiculous picture. It's this guy who's a schlubble.
It's the hermit. Guess how much this wine is.
$200.
Oh, come on.
Well, you heard what I said.
No, I would guess this wine would be $60.
So it's
$23.99. Whoa.
Yeah. So how do you feel about this wine? Do you think it's, you know, right up there?
The herbaceousness of the first one is back, I think.
That's very smoky.
This is a little more, just nosing it in line with the first one we tasted.
Flavor-wise, too, the herbaceousness, like, got a woodsy quality to it.
I think Rosemary. It's also easier, more upfront, riper, more plush fruit, which is, it's just like a little easier, more approachable wine in comparison.
I think it's leaner.
Yeah,
I don't think
definitely.
It has the depth and the weight of the first two wines. And I'm going to say, go on a limb and say it's less ripe than that Hermitage. I think that the fruit's a little bit less reserved. I think this might come from maybe some of their younger vines. I'm not quite sure with this one here.
Tannins are more pronounced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely harder. Yep. So 500 years, these guys have been making wine in this area. So, I mean, these are the producers that kind of made the Northern Rhone. So I think, but it's nothing to scoff at. For $25, this is a hell of a wine.
Absolutely.
Sorry, anything we're going to get, we can't even buy Napa wine for $25 anymore, dude, you know? We've already established that this is a high-quality region, and it costs a lot to make money there, so it's going to cost a lot to buy. So the reason we showed this Groz Hermitage was you can kind of be introduced to the region. You can try the style. You can understand a little bit of that meaty, the savory, the fruity, and the structure of Syrah and like why it's a wine geek's favorite wine without having to just jump into $80 right away.
Yeah.
So Groz Hermitage, the reason that they can drive the cost down, it's flatter. That's a flatter part of around the Hermitage Hill, so easier to, of course, grow wine there. And it's also the largest appellation of production in the Northern Rhone, so they just make the most.
And better for some situations, like dinner parties where you need two or three wines and you want something that reflects the terroir, you don't have $100 to spend per bottle, right?
Yeah, or you buy Hermitage for the dinner party and then or Groz Hermitage for the table, and you put this Hermitage underneath your chair by you and your best friend. This is the Domaine Vincent Paris Cornas 2016. So one thing that I didn't note earlier is you can co-ferment or blend white wine grapes in with the Syrah in these appellations. So Côte Rôtie, for example, it's very common that they co-plant, they co-ferment or blend Viognier, up to 20% Viognier. In terms of Hermitage, it's up to 15% Marsan and Roussan. So those are the three white grapes that are permissible in the Northern Rhone. But in Cornas, which is the furthest south of the Rhone Appalachians, it is only 100% Syrah allowed in the blend altogether. So no white varieties.
Wasn't it super cute when Australian producers started copying that same style and nobody gave a
shit? Yes. Well, they're still doing it. It's very cute.
Yulumba has one. Their Syrah or Shiraz Viognier is fantastic.
It's good.
Yeah.
Well, I wish people bought it. It's so good, but nobody
yes,
buys it.
Yes, and it's not expensive at all. No.
So what's the logic to that, Chris, to co-ferment Viognier?
So I think the reason that they started to do that was Viognier stabilized the color because Syrah is so reductive and it doesn't take the oxygen. I think it can mess with the color and also the aromas. And so it gives it aromatic lift. Viognier is a very aromatic grape. And so it gives it even more of that floral punch that I think that they really wanted, and help to moderate some of the acidity in Syrah. Pat?
So by co-ferment, these grapes are pressed together and fermented together?
Fermented before they're pressed, yeah. You ferment and then press red wine.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, not made into wine and then blended together, but actually made into wine
Yep,
together.
Fermented at the same time.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they're pulling from the skins from within the grape.
Some producers, you know, traditionally it was whole cluster fermentation. There's a few reasons to do this. You can add tannin. Some winemakers say that it actually helps to pull tannin from the skins to have some of the tannin from the stems present. That's just kind of how they feel. They say that it adds complexity, the herbaceous character, a black tea component, helps with color stabilization with the stems. Others say, well, it's hard to judge sometimes, depends on the person managing the vineyards, if the stem ripening is matched up with the berry ripening. So the berries could be ready to rock, but then you put the stems in and you're going to pull like green, pyrazinic kind of smells and aromas from the stem. So there's kind of like two camps. And some of these wines, some like Jamet, for example, some of the wines I do are whole cluster. And Hermitage, for example, this particular bottle we tried has all been destemmed. So there's kind of a different camp with stem inclusion. And so I think when it comes to co-fermentation, it's just kind of the same thing. It's what do you want to come out of this grape? What do you want to come out of that? What's the, you know, the percentage of the blend? Gigal, you guys probably know Gigal. They're probably one of the more famous producers in the Rhone. They famously have normally a 5 to 7% Viognier in their Côte Rôties, but Jamet just does 100% Syrah.
Something that audio doesn't do justice here is how beautiful this wine is.
That is really pretty.
It has like this really neat fuchsia violet color that's kind of mesmerizing.
I don't know. I gotta say, it's just I can't get over it. But it smells like purple.
It does smell like purple. It smells just like
purple drink.
I'm just overwhelmed. I mean, if I wrote a tasting note, that's all I would be able to write the first three sentences. Mm-hmm. Just, it's all purple and it's gorgeous floral.
It's super rich. Did I already say that on a different wine?
Yes,
I did.
This is very, very rich. And it's the warmest for the South. It's the warmest Appalachian. So generally, these wines can be seen as the fullest, kind of the most lush, fruity, round, velvety examples, yeah. Less structured than its cousins that come from up the river.
You're getting into notes of preserves.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
This has a violet character, which makes sense with the color. It reminds me of creme de violette a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
This is a tasty wine. This is very nice.
I think it has that really lush, ripe fruit you're talking about, but this is only 13%, so it's not overripe fruit. It's just very, very expressive.
Yep. $35.99.
Delicious.
That's a value. That's
I think awesome. So. You could charge $60 for this in some places.
Say what it is again.
Domaine Vincent Paris Cornas 2016.
I got to say, too, we tried a back vintage of this maybe a year ago, Chris. I want to say it was like 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't the Granite 30. It was one of their maybe single vineyard offerings, but by this producer. And it was one of the best wines I had all of last year. So Cornas also ages really well, right?
Absolutely. All these wines age pretty well. Yeah. We're talking 10, 15, 20 years, right up there with Burgundy and Bordeaux. I love these wines.
It's hard not to.
These are great BYO wines to really impress your guests or, you know, your dinner partners.
Bordeaux collecting friends.
Right. I mean, because people forget. They forget about these wines and they're gorgeous.
This was really eye-opening for me because I always kind of just, I thought Rhone was Rhone and I thought it was all like GSM, like fruit forward, you know, ripe fruity stuff. And I never really thought about it being these big heavy hitters that were cellar worthy and that kind of stuff. I mean, I'm exposing myself as the wine noob I am now, but that's fine. But I didn't realize that there was this kind of like really cool little nerd part of it tucked away up north there.
Yeah. I mean, they make so little wine, such small production. The families, a lot of them have such long histories making wine there. That just, you know, somebody like you would say, why the hell are you doing this? And they're like, well, this is what we've been doing for 16 generations. So yeah, it's its own kind of microcosm in the wine world because there's about a 30-mile or so difference between the North and Southern Rhone. And like just the topography, the climate, everything is completely different.
Yeah. And for me, it's actually interesting to hear you say that because for me, this has been eye-opening for the opposite reason that when I think of Northern Rhone as somebody that knows French wines a little bit better, I think of really harsh, aggressive tannin, very gamey,
closed
earthy,
down,
shut down. Yeah. And so today for me, they've been so fruit forward and accessible and delicious and approachable and lovely acidity that I'm just absolutely overwhelmed with how much I love these wines.
Yeah, these wines drink, you're right. You're absolutely right. They drink great straight out of the gate. They're just like ready to roll immediately, but then we'll just, you know, evolve and get better before, you know, if another 15 years, you could probably hold on to these things. Oh, Roger, do you want to give away some money?
Sure.
All right, Q&A time.
That brings us to the Q&A portion of Barrel to Bottle.
The same every episode. I'm taking it. All right, Roger, so we're going to start our Q&A portion of... that brings us to the Q&A portion of Barrel to Bottle. You can reach out to us at email, comments@binnies.com, or hit us up on social, Twitter, Insta, or Facebook.
At
whatever.
At Binnies Bev. Here's what we're going
to
do, Kristen. We're going to take three questions.
Okay.
And all three of them are going to get $20 Binnies gift cards.
Cool.
All right.
$60. Day. It's a good day.
Question number one comes from at AndreKM00, alternately Andrekamu. Question is?
Okay.
Smiley face emoji.
Give him $20.
We're going to give him $20.
Boy, we have lowered our standards.
You know what? I want people to know that we are actually taking their questions and we are giving away gift cards. So AndreKM00, thank you for your question. We have no answer to that because it's not actually a question.
I'm smiling.
Have a $20 Binnie's gift card for you.
I think the answer is the double crying laughing emoji.
Thumbs up emoji.
Thumbs up emoji.
We're giving this guy a gift card. This is the most millennial thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
Nope. This is the most millennial thing you've ever seen in your entire life. Question number two comes from at official Matt Brown fan club. Not sure who Matt Brown is, but he has an official fan club. And the question is, fart.
Did you hear that, Roger?
Well, yeah. It was probably supposed to be funny. I mean, it's a fair attempt. We'll give you $20. Just leave us alone, all right?
$20 to add official Matt Brown fan club?
Yeah.
What's the official emoji answer?
Eggplant, eggplant, peach.
No, it's obviously the wind, the fart, and then the poo. I mean, come on.
Gross. All right.
Do not give a guy a gift card for writing fart.
He wrote fart. And our real question this week comes via email from Ed Rutledge. Ed, thanks for writing in. Your question goes, generally, it seems that wine from a particular region will pair well with the food from that region. At the risk of asking a chicken or egg question, and assuming that this was not just an incredible global coincidence, did food evolve to accommodate the local wine, or did wine adapt to accommodate the local food?
I don't even know if this subject is touched on in Hugh Johnson's The Story of Wine, which basically goes back to like ancient Georgia till now. I don't know that is even like, who knows? I think it is chicken and egg. I mean,
right.
Nobody touches on it, I think, because there is no definitive.
Well, I think people were eating probably in the caves, right?
Yeah.
Before we had vines and we had wine to drink with that
people were eating food before they were drinking alcohol.
That's not true. Beer predated bread. It has to, have.
But it didn't predate eating, though. Like, sustenance predated beer. Like, we ate before we drank fermented beverages, for sure.
Yes. Yes, you know?
But we didn't make the fermented beverages to go with what we were eating.
No, I don't. I think this is a question about when did we start documenting food and
ancient Greece
alcohol culture? That's going to be back then.
And so, to my point, going to that book, which is like the one, you know, book about the entire history of wine. I don't remember that being like a point that carried through. So I don't really know, but my default answer is ancient Greece, but then really medieval times.
And okay, so the question is talking about locality. And one of the things we know is that wine is just one of the foodstuff products in Europe that has regional designations.
Yes.
Like cheese.
Right.
Goes back to when? The
13th century. Roquefort. Yeah.
So that like was regionally recognized and protected by law before wine ever came in. But at the same time, you're talking about a wine style that talking about wine grapes that were cultivated in an area because they did well in that area, alongside the foods that did well in that area. So, you know, you go to Chianti or Tuscany and you're on a hill, and there's grain on one side and there's grapes on the other side because that side gets more sun exposure. And they literally make pasta with the grain grown at the foot of the hill and pair it with the wine from the hill.
Yeah. You know, in Armagnac, they make highly acidic white table wines and they eat a ton of foie gras.
Yep.
And those are a great pairing. So
maybe it's not so much chicken and the egg thing, and it's just that's how people work, and they create things in a locality with what they have to work with. And it
went back to a time where, you know, it wasn't the transformative age. We didn't have transportation. They didn't have science. And so they just sort of stayed where they were, and things evolved and developed that way. So, yeah.
Thanks, Ed, for the question that we have a $20 Benny's gift card for you and you other two smiley face fart. Why not?
No. They're not getting them. I'll break your goddamn leg if you give them to them.
Hey, leave all this. Leave it. Oh, my God. This is great. I'm so happy I came to work today.
Get off of Roger's podcast lawn.
Kristen, thanks for bringing the Syrah.
Hey, man. Thanks for tasting the Syrah.
And Barb, thanks for sitting through this one with us.
Thanks for having me. It was
really
great.
Really glad to have you on.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Barrel to Bottle, the Benny's podcast. We'll be back soon. Until next time, I'm Greg.
I'm Kristen.
I was Barb.
I'm Roger.
I'm Pat.
Keep tasting.